Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of May. An article in Scientific American caught our attention. April 28 was the dateline of this. Brain games, do they really work? A recent multi-center clinical trial of a commercial brain fitness program makes a case for why we should take brain games more seriously. The games are based, the article says, in part on clear evidence that living in an enriched environment with lots of mental stimulation produces positive brain changes. And we agree that there's huge potential for tapping into your own neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change itself by remodeling nerve cell connections after experience to enhance mental fitness and to prevent age-related memory decline. We have two guests with us this hour of the program. Dr. Murali Doraswamy is with us, Chief of the Division of Biological Psychiatry, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the School of Medicine at Duke University and co-author of the Alzheimer's Action Plan. Dr. Doraswamy, make sure I have you on the right line.
Glad to be on your show.
Yes, thank you so much for being with us. It should be a really interesting conversation. Thanks for being here. Also joining us is Dr. Mark Agronin, who is Associate Professor of Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine and Director of Mental Health Services at the Miami Jewish Home and Hospital for the Aged. Dr. Agronin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. What made both of you decide that you were going to study brain games? Dr. Murali Doraswamy, you want to start? Why study these?
Well, there's a huge buzz about this topic. And, you know, virtually every day, I think you read stories about brain fitness being analogous to physical fitness, sort of the use it or lose it scenario, if you will. And clearly, you know, we're all aging. There's 10 million baby boomers at risk for Alzheimer's disease. So if there's anything that we can do to really improve our mental fitness to stave off age-related cognitive decline and make us perform better in our day-to-day lives, I'm all for it. And I really was excited about looking into this area.
Yeah. And what do we mean by brain games, Dr. Agronin?
Well, I agree with Dr. Doraswamy completely. We see individuals in our clinics every day who are looking to do something to improve their memory. So a brain game would be something that challenges either memory or some other cognitive function that helps a person practice it to improve the skills. We sometimes use the analogy of you go to the gym and you pump iron to increase your muscle strength and endurance. Your brain obviously is not a muscle, but by exercising it in other ways through different types of games or exercises, we hope to increase the strength of so many cognitive skills and your endurance in many different mentally challenging situations.
Isn't it remarkable that we have these memories, and for some of us, they're incredibly strong? Whenever I meet people who can remember so many things, all the books that they've read, and their memory goes way back to when they were very young, they remember experiences. It just strikes me as quite a skill to be able to remember as deeply as some do.
Absolutely. You know, memory is what makes us unique as humans. And some people even attribute memory as one of the essential ingredients of what we call as consciousness. So it's really very important to success in life, whether it be personal life. You know, you need to remember at a simplistic level your birthday anniversary or your wedding anniversary to a more complicated things at work. So having a great memory puts you way ahead of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about long-term memory, it really underscores the fact that there are many different types of memory. You can have memories for distant experiences and facts. You can have memories for more recent issues. You have memories tied into your senses, things that you saw, that you heard, that you smelled. And so one of the goals of brain games is to engage all those different aspects of your memory.
And, you know, memory is just one cognitive skill. So if you think of the brain and the different lobes of the brain, much like you think of the different muscles in your body, what we've learned is cognitive abilities are distributed through the brain, and there are specific parts of the brain that are responsible for specific cognitive abilities. But some aspects of cognition, like memory, might actually be distributed through many different parts of the brain. So in a way, it's like, you know, cell phone towers. The more cell phone towers you have, the less likely you are to drop a call. And really, the key goal of something like a brain game is to try to maximize your networks so that you have maximal coverage for what you need in your day-to-day life.
And how do we describe brain games? What are they, and which ones do you think are most effective?
Mark, do you want
This is exactly what we're interested in looking at, because on the one hand, any daily activity that you engage in to some extent can mentally challenge you, and it can be some form of a game. You could be listening to the radio and trying to think of what is the name of the song that you're listening to. But usually with this term brain game that is being popularized now really refers to a more structured program such as that can be set up on a computer where you're actually being challenged on a specific skill, such as trying to remember a fact from a list of different things, or trying to focus on something that moves around on the screen, or something having to do with the way you process auditory sounds. So a game tries to pick one particular area and structure it. And I guess maybe a good analogy is if you go to a gym, you can just pick up a barbell and do free weights, or you can get onto a machine that actually targets a particular muscle group. And this is really what the games try to do, is target one of these particular cognitive skills that Dr. Doraswamy just mentioned a minute ago.
Mm-hmm. And how do you decide if they're working? How are you looking at the brain?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. The field is growing. We need to be very clear that we evaluate these tests objectively, and so we need to define what we mean by work. I don't think the field has quite come to a consensus. So I think at a simplistic level, when most of us pick up a brain game, we expect to see benefits that are appreciable in our day-to-day functioning. So I think that needs to be the goal. Now, the second goal, which is sort of a medical goal, is to see if we can prevent or stave off age-related diseases of the brain, such as maybe Alzheimer's or mild memory loss. But I think that's the next step, and I don't think we're quite there yet. So the immediate goal of these games is one, obviously you want it to be fun and challenging, so give you some pleasure at that level, give you a workout of your brain. And two, really improve your functional abilities to the point that you can notice in your day-to-day life. And I think at a molecular level, there is also some evidence from animal studies that systematically training your brain can awaken and sprout new nerve cell connections and maybe release what we call as nerve growth factors. So these are like fertilizers for the brain. So I think those are well documented in animal studies, but we are hoping that a brain game that works will also induce those same changes in the human brain.
Mm-hmm. It's such a key issue for aging, because a lot of people assume that as you get older, the only effects that you have on brain function are on a declining slope. And one of the issues that these games try to emphasize, and as clinicians that we emphasize as well, is that there still is a possibility to learn and to grow, and ideally these games will assist in that process.
Hmm. I guess our common wisdom about this, maybe we're looking at something quite new, is that nerve cell growth takes place mostly at the ages, of two, and then it takes place again when you're a teenager, and after that it's all downhill.
Right, and I think that's the old myth, and studies have now disproved that fairly conclusively, I would say. So even the adult brain retains the capacity for both neurogenesis and neuroplasticity. So these are two technical terms. Neurogenesis is the ability to sprout new cells and new connections, and neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain to change itself based on experience. So the adult brain definitely retains that, and one of the goals really of brain games is to try to tap into these innate abilities of the brain to maximize our cognitive skills.
And give me more of an idea of where we're finding these games. Are you talking about Test Your IQ that you see every time you go to one of your favorite websites, or are these specific games distributed by some educational organization? Where are you getting them?
Well, in the last 5 years, there's been an explosion of these. And, for instance, at our facility, we've been working to create what we call our brain gym. And so we've actually gone out and purchased a number of these programs. And there's a whole variety of them. I think there are maybe six major ones that you can actually purchase. You can also go on the web. There are a number of websites that have games that you can do. These are at least programs or games that have been specifically designed primarily for older individuals who want to improve memory skills. You know, that being said, I mean, any game that a lot of that kids use all the time, the Wii, Nintendo, all of those also have effects on improving brain skills.
Really?
As well. But they're more marketed for kids versus adults.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we really need is a standard set of guidelines, if you will, in the field. For example, you go to the U.S. Department of Education's website, and they have some recommendations as to the kinds of training programs that are good for children. For example, children with learning disabilities or children with special needs. And we don't have anything like that when it comes to brain training for adults. And eventually, I would expect to see, you know, something like the National Institutes of Health systematically rate all these games to see if they meet a threshold for scientific evidence and benefit, and then, you know, give them anything from 1 to 5 stars or whatever system we use, so that, you know, the general public really can discriminate good evidence-based products from snake oil. And I think part of the reason that we wrote this article was to try to sort of bring a little bit of that scrutiny into this field.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you about the other things that we just do normally, things like doing crossword puzzles or making sure that you always have a couple books, and whether there's a difference between reading novels or reading nonfiction. Watching, you mentioned in your article, the History Channel or something that's going to teach you something that you didn't know before. What about all those things that are already around us? Are they as valuable as these brain games that we're talking about?
Well, this is such an important question, because if individuals are going out and spending money on a program, they probably would like to know that it's going to be more effective or give them unique benefits compared to simply watching a TV program or buying a book of puzzles, which is going to cost a lot less. That's something which is really being investigated now. I think what we're seeing from some of the studies are signals from the data that do point to some unique benefits from them. But this is still an open question.
And you know, I agree with that, and I want to add to that. I think eventually, you know, if you think of an analogy of, say, a tennis player, you know, a tennis player can play tennis on their own against a back wall, or they can have a special coach that systematically trains them. And you know, all of us, if we go to a gym, if we have, like, an attractive, experienced trainer, we're, I think, more likely to get a better workout than if we were to just sort of meander around the gym by ourselves. Again, it varies from person to person. So I think eventually I can see where brain games that are structured well and scientifically will really achieve a higher standard. But as Dr. Gnonen pointed out, what we need are really head-to-head comparison studies saying, you know, is listening to an NPR radio show as good? I think the key are it has to be novel, and it has to be challenging, and it needs to be interesting so that you don't give up prematurely. You want to stick to it and persist with it.
Yeah. What do both of you do to strengthen your brains?
Well, Mark? I've thought about this a lot, because I would say if I've identified an area for me that I would like to improve on, and that is remembering names of things.
Yes.
I see so many different individuals and patients during the day, and I'm always challenged to remember names. So I started this game I do in the car. I have satellite radio, and of course I listen to NPR as well. But on one of the music stations, I go era by era, starting from the 30s, 40s, and up through the 70s and 80s, and I listen to the music, and I try to remember what is the name of the song over time. And I found, at least anecdotally, that over time it seems to me that my memory for names is a little better. It's a fun thing to do in the morning when I'm driving to work, and it is akin to a lot of the brain games that people do on computers right now.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, and you know, the key is, for me at least, is I force myself to try new things, you know, that I might have resisted. So the most important thing is don't stick with something that you're so comfortable with that you sort of are afraid to get out of your comfort zone. So try new things, you know, whether it be picking up, you know, a new iPhone and trying to sort of, you know, program something on it, or trying to create a page for yourself on Facebook or MySpace with multimedia in it. So things that you don't do, I think all of those things, your brain just comes alive. It's like a little child just given a rattle. You know, it sucks on it, it smells it, it bites on it, it shakes it. So that multiple senses in your brain are like coming alive. And that, to me, is really critical.
Mm-hmm.
On that note, in our memory programs, when we give individuals advice, we often say just as Dr. Doraswamy emphasizes, to try something new and don't worry so much about performance.
That's right.
Just that you're doing it. If you're going to study a new language, study it, enjoy it. You don't have to be fluent in it, but you're challenging your brain. And we even know from data that what's key is when your brain has to do something different, there seems to be greater neuronal growth.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a remarkable study that kind of blew me away. They taught a group of individuals the act of juggling, you know, taking three or four balls and juggling. These are individuals who had never done juggling in their life, so the activity was very novel, it's very challenging, and it involves a lot of motor cognitive coordination to focus on it and practice it. And what they found was even if people didn't get really good at juggling, they still saw benefits in the brain as soon as 1 week after they started practicing.
Huh. Well, maybe I'll take that up this afternoon then.
There you go.
A little bit of juggling. The article also talks, and I'm wondering how you do these exams of people, that you may not be seeing big changes in scores in terms of cognitive abilities if you are already cognitively fit.
Yes, this is one of the challenges, what's called a ceiling effect, is that if you have relatively normal memory skills, the programs might not improve you much above and beyond where you are already, or if it does improve you, it's a small difference. It's difficult to measure it. Part of the question that is going to be critical to get at in the near future is whether someone with some existing memory impairment or even with a more formal disorder such as a dementia, such as Alzheimer's disease, can get benefit from these particular games. Now, we're beginning to see data pointing in that direction, but one of the challenges is that you need programs that are designed for individuals with impairment. Some of the existing programs, you can purchase it, but it takes a little bit of sophistication on the computer to get it set up, to log in, to engage in the program, and that can be more challenging, at least we found in our memory program, with individuals who have some existing impairment.
And, you know, as we mentioned in our book, the Alzheimer's Action Plan, which, by the way, is for both people with early-stage memory problems as well as sort of, you know, anyone just wondering what I can do to keep my brain healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, brain games are not the only sort of recourse to keeping a brain healthy. I think it requires an overall sort of holistic program, which involves everything from, you know, socializing to keeping yourself physically fit to making sure you're eating healthy and also controlling your vascular risk factor. So I think brain games need to be put in the perspective of this overall sort of health lifestyle.
Well, it's interesting because one thing that wasn't measured as much in these studies, they're looking for improvement in performance, but there's also the larger issue of well-being and how someone feels doing it. And when you ask people how they feel exercising or taking walks every day, they might not say, well, I can walk faster or better or I know I'm stronger, but they just feel better. They feel better about themselves.
Sure.
They're more motivated to do things. And this is also a key goal of these brain games.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guests are co-authors of a piece in Scientific American, April 28, Brain Games, Do They Really Work? Dr. Mark Gronin is Associate Professor of Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine and Director of Mental Health Services, Miami Jewish Home and Hospital for the Aged. Dr. Murali Doraswamy is Chief of the Division of Biological Psychiatry, Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences in the School of Medicine at Duke University, and co-author of a book he was just talking about, Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Action Plan, what you can do and what you need to know about memory problems from prevention to early intervention and care. We'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start taking your phone calls now and begin with Carl from Peshtigo. Hi, Carl.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hello.
Thank you. I get some issues sometimes with anxiety and emotional distress. And what does that contribute to memory stability or loss or coherentness?
Well, it's a great question. And whenever we evaluate anyone with concerns about their memory, Before really even thinking about a memory disorder, we first want to know emotionally how they're doing, medically how they're doing. There's so many different completely reversible issues that can impair memory, from sleep deprivation being one of the most common. There's certain commonly used over-the-counter medications, a lot of sleeping pills that can sometimes impair memory. And, of course, anxiety and depression are big culprits for that. And so sometimes by addressing those issues first and getting treatment for it in some form or another can make all the difference in terms of memory. This is particularly important for older individuals who, as they get into their 70s or 80s, have memory lapses, and the first thing they think or worry about is that they must be getting Alzheimer's disease. And again, we emphasize that that's not the first thought that we have as physicians who treat this all the time. We want to know what are these other intervening factors that could be making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to Virginia from Oconomowoc. Hi, Virginia.
Hello.
Hello.
Years ago, I learned the bad habit of falling asleep while I read. So now I would like to know what kind of activities can I do that will help me stay awake and alert while I read.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I would need to know a little bit more, before I can give you all of the detailed possibilities as to why that might be happening. But I think one common reason might be, you know, if you're reading in the middle of the day after a big meal, or if you're reading at night after a big dinner, I mean, obviously that could be one reason. There is in some people a very rare condition called narcolepsy where, you know, people sometimes fall asleep. And I'm assuming you don't have that condition. But I think the body might also just get acclimatized if someone is not getting enough physical activity. So one common piece of advice I would give people if they're feeling fatigued is one is to make sure they're getting enough physical activity during the day. Eat small meals during the day rather than big meals. There are some medical causes of fatigue, such as, for example, hormonal imbalances, for example, anemia if you're having some blood loss, if you're having some vitamin deficiencies or thyroid imbalance. So I think if this is a problem that's getting worse over time, or if it's something that's seriously affecting you, then you should talk to a doctor. But if it's just very mild and, you know, perhaps it's something that you're not getting enough physical activity, then I would suggest you try to increase that.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for the call. Let's talk. I know, Dr. Doraswamy, you write about prevention measures and about keeping your brain healthy. You do believe there's a preventive area that's very helpful at the back of the book in the use of some vitamins. Others you think are really a lot of hooey.
Well, there's no magic bullet for preventing Alzheimer's disease. We wish we had a magic pill, but we don't have a magic pill. I think the best things that we can do to postpone Alzheimer's disease are, one is to lower our risk for strokes. And the way you can do that is by making sure all your vascular risk factors, for example, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your body weight, your cholesterol levels, all those are in the normal range, and your doctor can help you get those in the normal range if they're not. The second thing we recommend is sort of just leading a brain-healthy lifestyle that includes things like keeping your brain stimulated and active, being physically active, socially active, and also just making sure your diet is brain-healthy. In terms of vitamins, I think if you're deficient in vitamins, it's very important to make sure that your B vitamins, you know, B for the brain, I think B vitamins are very important, so make sure you're getting plenty of those, and you can take a multivitamin once a day if you are not sure if you're getting enough of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add anything to that, Dr. O'Gronin?
Well, what I think is wonderful about this advice is that we assume that you have to either pay a lot of money or go to some super specialist or, you know, find some guru someplace to give you the exact formula to do this. But to protect your brain, to improve your skills, to reduce your risk of Alzheimer's disease is accessible to everyone, and it really boils down to a lot of the very straightforward suggestions that Dr. Doraswamy provided. You know, some of the studies, it's remarkable in terms of the risk reduction. One study in particular looked at a group of older Japanese Americans and found that those who drank three or more glasses of fruit or vegetable juice a week had an astounding over 70% risk reduction in Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, my.
Now, it's not to say that this applies to everyone or you just have to drink fruit and vegetable juice, you're not going to get it. But what it does suggest is that some very simple and straightforward tips that we all recognize as common wisdom, healthy diet, exercise, maintain your health, can really make a difference.
And I think this is particularly important if you have a father or mother who's developed Alzheimer's at a relatively younger age, then I think you would have a slightly higher risk, and these strategies would be particularly important, I think, for that kind
right.
of person.
Let's go next to Michael from Madison. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a juggler, and you were talking about juggling earlier.
Right.
And one of the problems that I have when I juggle is after I do about four or five cycles, that it's like my brain gets bored with it, and
yeah.
all of a sudden I try to work in new patterns.
And I love that, and the brain loves it. And I think you should continue doing that, because once you reach your threshold and you get bored with it, there is some belief that perhaps, at that point, sort of the brain gets into an automatic mode and stops growing.
It's one of the challenges with the brain games that people have reported, that if they're doing the same thing over and over again, they do get bored with it, and it becomes less of a challenge. So ideally what a game does is really matches up your profile with a whole mixture of games, and then over time changes it. I know one of the brain games in particular, you actually have a subscription to it, and it changes it on a weekly basis, and so there's always new and fresh material.
Huh.
Think about someone who's a marathon runner or who participates in Ironman. You're always trying to mix up your training and do one part of your body one day, another part the other day. One day you'll swim, one day you'll run. And maybe even with juggling, if this is something that you love and you do all the time, you can find ways to juggle different materials or different numbers of items over time to try to break the cycle up. Maybe it does get a little monotonous at times.
Is that helpful, Michael?
Thank you very much.
All right.
I was a late bloomer, so I'm kind of taking this up in my old age here.
Great. Congratulations, by
yes.
the way. That's a great skill.
Yes, thank you so much, Michael, for the call. Let's go to Tom from Whitewater. Hi, Tom.
Well, this is fascinating. In my professional background, I studied learning theory for many, many years. And one of the interesting historical things was back in the late 1800s, on into the 1900s, in children's curriculum, they did things like having them memorize long poems and not for the poetry, but because they said it was brain exercise. Later on, other learning theorists said that was a lot of garbage, because there was no such thing as just the brain being a muscle. And from what I hear you talking about, it sounds as though we're back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, and saying the brain is a muscle and it needs lots of exercise. And I would just like you to comment on that.
Well, that's really giving us a great perspective. I want to remind everyone that there's really a lot of things about the brain we don't know, so we have to be humble. There's this great saying which goes, if the brain were so simple that we could understand it, then we would be so simple that we couldn't understand it. But that said, I truly believe, at least, again, this is my personal belief, there's a very interesting theory of brain development called pruning. And what that says is that when we are born and in our early childhood, there are far more nerve cells and far more connections than we actually need. And what the brain is waiting is to see which connections and which pathways you're really going to use. And the ones you are using a lot get strengthened, and the ones that you don't use a lot get pruned off. It's almost like a gardener trimming out all the weeds from your garden in your brain. And so that theory, I think, is now firmed up quite a bit. And so if you believe that theory, then clearly the activities that you really strengthen in your childhood are going to be very important throughout your life.
Anything else, Tom?
No, that's very interesting. I There was one other thing I might comment on, if as long as we have the time, is that after the early beliefs about the brain being exercised, and that was one of the reasons why they had eighth grade kids memorize Evangeline and its totality, is that later theorists said, well, no, you have to be more specific, and that if you want kids to learn logic, you don't just teach them geometry, but you teach them logic. And that way they will develop their facilities for logic. And if you want them to learn geometry, you teach them geometry. But that there's relatively little transfer to logic just from learning geometry. But anyway, that's just a side comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Well, one thing, even learning poems, it can teach history and culture, and there's meter and rhyme to it, and like with any good brain game, you're engaging as many different types of memory and other cognitive skills as possible, and that's really the secret. It's not just rote memory, but trying to challenge you in so many different ways.
Mm. So let me get this straight. Is it a good idea, and would it help our brains to memorize Shakespeare's sonnets?
Well, you know, this raises a very interesting question, and this was in one of the studies that we looked at, is that if you work one particular skill over and over, does the improvement generalize to other skills in the brain? So, for instance, the main study that we looked at, which is involved a brain fitness program by Posit Science, their program primarily focuses on auditory processing. And what they wanted to demonstrate is that if you focus on that one particular area, does it generalize then to other skills? And they had found, indeed, that to some extent it does. So it's a very interesting theoretical way to look at it.
Let's go to an email. Do we really need these games, or can we get a similar benefit from simple things like brushing our teeth with the opposite hand, rearranging the kitchen cupboards, or taking different routes to work?
It's a great question, and I don't think it's going to be either or. And I think at the end of the day, what we're going to find is we're going to try to use all of the tools we have available so that we can get the maximum benefits. And, you know, some people might like the structure of a game. There are many people who love computers, who love computer games, you know. And other people might like doing things like learning a new dance or learning a new language or taking a different route to work. So I think it's good to have a variety of these. And I suspect in the long run, they're all going to confer benefits. And, you know, there's going to be slightly different benefits that are conferred by each of these activities.
Let's go next to Steve from Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Great program. I think you've already touched on a number of topics that I was going to bring up. But at age 51, I decided to go back to school and get my graduate degree. And I hadn't been an undergraduate since 25, 26 years earlier. But, you know, that took a little while to get accustomed to it and just the reading. But I'd never been one on crossword puzzles, and I'd never been one to play those little brain games, but I know a lot of people who are. But and this is strictly anecdotal, but I find that people who are into those, the ones that I know, are very good at those. But when it comes to more comprehensive thinking, and maybe theoretical thinking, they're just not as adept at it, and not as interested in it. They're more interested in like doing watching Jeopardy, or
oh, that's interesting,
crossword puzzles, or maybe just doing what I call petty little things. They get kind of mad at me when I use those kind of words, but I mean, to me, that's not interesting. Small little tidbits of facts that are interesting, but more of a theoretical concept, and whether they can put that into a semblance of an idea.
Well, it speaks to the fact that there are many different types of intelligence, and that someone may have certain strengths in certain areas and motivation to pursue areas and not in others. It also raises another very interesting and, I think, important issue for individuals as they age, to keep in mind that it's not just that you build up more experience, but you also build up different ways of thinking about things. And so for you as a student in your 50s versus students in their 20s, you may approach the topics with a way of thinking and processing the material in a way that maybe at first seems different and perhaps in terms of the skills that you're practicing every day is maybe not as strong initially compared to the younger students. But we use this concept of wisdom to describe the fact that you may have a much broader way of looking at topics that actually gives you an advantage later in life. And again, it points out the fact that we should not look at aging just in terms of disease and decline, but aging in terms of growth and development, not only on the cellular level, but also on a functional and social level as well.
And thank you very much for the call. I'm wondering about rest. We know that the body needs so much rest, and if you don't get your proper sleep, you got all kinds of problems. And I'm wondering if the brain needs a certain amount of rest as well. In addition to being stimulated, do you think that it performs better if you do some kind of meditation every day, some kind of yoga every day, if you try to clear your mind of all thoughts?
Well, I think so. I think it speaks to two things. One is rest at a cellular level. We need sleep. There are phases during our sleep that are very critical for memory consolidation. So, for example, there's a part of our sleep that's called REM sleep, which is where we tend to dream, etc. And studies have shown that if you consistently wake up individuals during their REM sleep and prevent them from getting REM sleep, their memory for events the next day is far weaker than someone who has gotten sound sleep through all of the different stages. And, you know, virtually all mammals need sleep, and many people. And it's very interesting, the chemicals that our brain uses for sleep, one of the chemicals called acetylcholine, is the same chemical that's also involved in forming memories. So there is a very solid connection between sleep and memory formation and the strengthening of memory. And some people even think the brain actually consolidates and parcels out memories to different parts of the brain during sleep. And it's sort of your dreaming is a way of sort of going through all of the different events that are being sort of archived from one bookshelf to another, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second aspect that you brought up, meditation, I think that deals with, I think, both the issue of rest and also stress. Anytime we're stressed out, that's excessive stress is bad for the brain, both at a physical level and also you're not paying attention. So if you can't pay attention, you're not encoding things properly. And if too much stress causes the release of cortisol and other hormones that can damage nerve cells. So I think meditation is really good for improving attention and also relieving stress.
One great concern is if you look at individuals with chronic depression and chronically elevated levels of cortisone, you know, theoretically we're concerned that it actually damages the very cells that encode memories in the brain and may even be a major risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia.
Let's pause for just a moment. We'll return and take more phone calls. And here is how you reach us. One line is open, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And gentlemen, let's take a couple quick emails for you. One from La Crosse. Who wonders about multiple sclerosis and what happens to nerve connection as a result of that disease? Can it disrupt forming memories? And how can such mental activity reroute connectivity, if at all?
Well, the primary manifestations of multiple sclerosis tend to be motor, at least initially and most prominently. Basically, in the disease, individuals in certain regions of the central nervous system lose some of the insulating material around nerves, and so you get impairments in transmission. However, we do know with a certain percentage of individuals with multiple sclerosis that you can also get memory impairment and even a form of a dementia, which is a more global impairment in cognitive function. And so there's no question that for individuals with MS, it's important that as much as they have physical follow-up that they also have monitoring of their memory. It also raises the issue of whether some form of cognitive rehabilitation might be particularly important for these individuals. Cognitive rehabilitation would be a more formal way of improving memory, but perhaps even the brain games could have an effect as well. One term we often use is what's known as cognitive reserve, and this refers to the general amount of brain tissue you have working at different problems, and then the more connections you have over time that may blunt the effects of any disease process.
And, you know, MS affects what's called as the white matter in the brain. So it's sort of like affecting the wires that transmit the information rather than the towers themselves. And there are a lot of things, you know, people can try to do. It can, you know, obviously you can try to write things down. The speed of processing is a particular problem for people. They tend to sometimes get tired. So you can try to note things down. I think it's important to try to see if you can focus attention and repeat things perhaps that you want to remember over and over again. So there are some simple strategies that people can try to do, but I think eventually people are trying to come up with games like Dr. Gronin mentioned. But I don't think we should call them games. I think maybe brain fitness strategies, if you will, or brain fitness techniques that can perhaps help these individuals.
Right. Let's go to Malka from Viroqua. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, this is fascinating. I'm actually just writing an email to someone that I think I'm getting Alzheimer's because I forgot something she said last night. But my question is, I am 61, and I recently, 3 years ago, I started and started a business. Would I'm in indirect sales, something similar to Tupperware, except we're selling different products. And would that have the same effect as doing these memory games on my brain?
Well, if you think of all the skills that go into running a business.
Pardon me?
When you think of all of the skills that go into running a business, there's no question that you're doing something new and different. You're challenging yourself. Not only are you engaging in all those skills on your own, but you're also getting out and interacting with other individuals. And that interaction, that socialization, we know makes a difference. In fact, we know that something that reduces the risk of Alzheimer's disease are individuals who are more socially active. And there's no question, especially if you're doing sales, that that's part of it. And you also introduce another key component here, and that's motivation. Because if you're doing sales in particular, you have to be out there meeting with people, pushing sales. You're highly motivated to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And with any exercise like this, the more you want to make change, the more you want to get involved in it, the more energy you're going to put into it.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
So
yeah,
that's great.
And the key thing, you know, a lot of people worry that they're getting Alzheimer's, but one key thing to remember is, you know, if you can remember what you forgot, in other words, if it comes back to you a little later, you know, the odds are it's probably not Alzheimer's. You're either stress, you're multitasking, taking on too many things, you're not focusing enough attention on what it is that you were trying to remember. So
yeah.
So that's I think, you know, if on the other hand, you're finding that memory is getting worse steadily over time and it's starting to interfere with your work, you know, that's where sort of I would tell people that, you know, they need to consider sort of a memory problem, et cetera. But if it's sort of an occasional lapse, like, you know, where you left something or, you know, where you forgot to park your car in an airport, you know, I forget every time I go to the airport where I park my car. So that's perfectly normal, I think.
Even you do?
Yes.
Surely you must have some strategy for that.
Well, the strategy now I have is that I send myself a text message on my cell phone as to where I parked my car.
Oh, my gosh.
That's smart. That's good. That's very comforting. Thank you.
Thank
One
you.
Thing I have to say, we as physicians who treat individuals with memory disorders, and I learned this very, very firsthand when we began offering memory classes, is that you may start off as the teacher, but we find out we're students as well. Memory issues affect everyone across the lifespan. There's no question, especially in a day today where we're all trying to do a lot more things than our brains can reasonably handle. And so whether they're brain games, whether they're different mental fitness exercises, are really for everyone across the lifespan. And I have to add that what fascinated me is when I met with a main salesperson for one of these companies that sells these. I asked them, who is your main audience? He said one country is buying thousands and thousands of their games, not for the elderly, but for school children.
Oh, interesting. All right, let's go to Victoria from Ridgeway. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
Hi.
My question, I perform regularly and often in the folk music, and the format is usually a verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse. By the third time I get to the chorus, I blank on the chorus. That happens to me more often than not. And what is causing that kind of thing to happen?
do you find with performances that you get nervous?
No, I absolutely love them, which is the funny part.
Because I ask because sometimes performance anxiety can get in the way with memory as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the key is to ask yourself, is this something that you've had all along, or is this an ability that's getting worse? In other words, is this a new problem that's steadily getting worse? If it's the latter, then that's what I would be concerned about. But if it's a difficult thing you're trying to memorize and there's a certain limit that you're hitting and this has been common for you throughout your adult life, then I would say that's more a strategic issue where you can sort of learn some techniques that can help you sort of memorize things better. And that might involve things like memorization. There's a variety of techniques on the internet, and we recommend some in our book, but we don't go into that as much detail. But on the other hand, if it's something that's happening just recently, you've never had a problem with this, and just over the last few months it's happening, and it's happening more and more, then that, I think, is a different issue.
It is a different... I mean, it is recent, and it happens a couple... 2-3 times a year, but that's too much for me.
Mm-hmm. If it just happens 2-3 times a year, but the other 30-40 times you're perfectly fine, then I think it's pretty benign, probably.
Right.
Because if you think about Microsoft, it might crash every day, and whereas our brain, look how good it is. We use it every day, and you give it a break and it can crash 1 or 2 times a year. That's probably okay.
Exactly. Just don't perform those 1 or 2 days, right, Victoria?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I know which days.
Well, I can memorize 2-hour plays and perform, but it's those little songs and little snippets. I forget the third time through, and it's quite embarrassing.
Yeah, I'm
the
sure.
Fact that you remember,
thank you.
Thank you.
The fact that you can remember such large bodies of material would argue against any sort of problem. But the one thing I do want to emphasize is that for training your memory, it does take time and energy. People will go to the gym and they'll realize that you can't work out one day and suddenly your muscles are larger. And yet we find sometimes with memory courses, people will take one session and say, well, it's not working, not realizing that it takes a lot of training. And when you find people who have sometimes amazing memories, it often is because they spend a lot of time working at these techniques until they really have them down pat.
That's right. There's a study, actually, that came out that shows any athlete, and this is for physical athletes that this study was referring to, that it needs 10,000 hours of training to become a world-class athlete. Now, so we're all trying to be brain athletes, and so, even if we can get 10,000 hours, I think practice, I think that's key. And then, there are some simple tricks that the memory likes, like associations. The brain is very associative. The more associations you can form, the more things you can sort of link what it is that you're trying to memorize with other things that are easy to pull up, I think the better you'll be able to remember things.
Right. We have a couple minutes left, but I don't want to leave the show without both of you giving advice to our audience as to where we're supposed to go for these brain games, or we won't be able to get as smart as we'd like to be.
Well, I would first say that if someone has a concern about their memory, don't be afraid to talk to your doctor about it. 9 times out of 10, there are very simple issues that are making the difference, and better to address those right away instead of spending needless time worrying about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing I'd emphasize. And the second thing is to keep in mind that if you don't enjoy doing it, you're not going to continue doing it. And so at the end of the day, if you look across all the different games and all the different possibilities, pick something or try something that you enjoy, that's different, and that will keep you motivated, and that will take you over the time needed to really make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think one has to differentiate brain games from a medical prescription for a brain training program. So I want to make sure that when people are using the word brain games or attempting to purchase one, they realize that it's a brain game. That, so if you have a serious memory problem and you're worried about it and you're having trouble with driving, trouble with performing in your daily life, I don't think the brain game is the first thing you should necessarily reach for and substitute that for a medical evaluation. So that said, if you're looking for something, so it depends. There are some that you can play online. There are some that require a handheld device. There are some that require more sophisticated setup. So there's these 3 different things. I would recommend a website for people to go.
Sure.
It's called Sharp Brains. Sharp Brains is a it's sort of a marketing, it's a advisory think tank kind of company that set up a website, and through that you can navigate to many different resources. I would say Nintendo has a very simple, fun to use brain game. It's called Brain Age. The first time you play it, it tells you sort of a quirky little thing like what's your brain age. That's not really your true neurological brain age. It's just a computer-derived age, but at least you can work your age down. It's kind of fun to start with a brain age of 50 and then work it down to that of a 27-year-old. if you want something that's more rigorous, more scientifically studied in a clinical trial, there's a company called Posit Science. They have something called as a brain fitness program that's on the more expensive end, some $300 or so dollars, but that offers sort of a very systematic cross-training for your brain. Again, keep in mind that this is early days and don't expect sort of a magic bullet.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful hour. Lots and lots of interest in the topic. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Our guest, Dr. Mark Agronin, Associate Professor of Psychiatry, and that's at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, Director also of Mental Health Services at Miami Jewish Home and Hospital for the Aged. We also thank Dr. Murali Doraswamy, who is the Chief of the Division of Biological Psychiatry and a Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences School of Medicine at Duke University, co-author of a very interesting book, The Alzheimer's Action Plan. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production. And thank you, everybody, for listening.